I like to keep the heat in, if possible. We were just going to mention number three, the historical difficulty. That is to say, not the difficulty with the mind and attitude of a person who would write a book with so much good in it and yet use deceit in its presentation, but the question of whether it could be done, the historical difficulty. People were not any more stupid in those days than they are today. Would they, finding a book in the temple there that somebody had just written and had put in there, would they think that it was something that came from 800 years or so before? Would the ink be all dried up? Would the paper be worn and fragile? Would there be all the evidences of it being an ancient document? Would they succeed in persuading people that this actually had come from Moses if there was no realization that such a thing had occurred among people before? The historical difficulty in the fraud theory is a very great one. And it is no wonder, therefore, that people have tried to evade this difficulty by saying it wasn't a fraud at all. It's interesting that you have both viewpoints of it presented in the Hastings Dictionary of the Bible. In the Hastings Dictionary of the Bible, in volume 2, page 368, Mr. F.H. Woods, in his article there, says of Deuteronomy, "The majority of critics believe this book of the law to have been the result of a pious fraud promulgated by Hilkiah and Shaphan with the intention of deceiving Josiah into the belief that the reforms which they desired were the express command of God revealed to Moses." You see a very definite stand taken that it was a fraud on the part of this article in Volume 2 of the Hastings Dictionary of the Bible. But in Volume 1 of that dictionary, the article by Ryle, if you're all familiar with Ryle, I believe, by the way, there are two Ryles, you know. I believe they were father and son, though I'm not sure of that. But there was the father, Ryle, who was the Bishop of Liverpool, who I believe was a very godly man, who wrote some very fine books in support of biblical ideas and presentation of biblical doctrine. And it's my impression the younger one was his son, though I'm not certain of that. But it was the younger Ryle who wrote the book on the canon of the Old Testament that you read last semester. Well, he has an article here in the Hastings Dictionary of the Bible in Volume 1, page 602-3, in which he says the very opposite. He says, "The finding of this book of the law in the temple is described as a fortuitous occurrence. There is no foundation for the suggestion that Hilkiah himself had written the book, and that the story of its finding was a fabrication. The account is straightforward and natural. It is generally agreed that the book may have been written in the reign of Manasseh, or in the early part of the reign of Josiah." You see how he, like so many of the present-day critics, feel that this is just impossible to believe, morally and historically, that it could be a fraud written as it was and then put in there intentionally to be taken up. And so this is point number four. Driver and others seek to evade. Driver and others seek to evade the moral and historical difficulty by saying that the book was not a fraud. They tried to avoid the moral and historical difficulty by saying that the book was not a fraud, though written many centuries after the time of Moses. Now, as Devetti advanced the theory, of course, it was definitely a fraud, definitely intended for that purpose, to deceive, to get the people to think something was by Moses, which really wasn't. Now, some critics try to say, well, it was just a way of saying this is the law, Moses said. Just a term to introduce a law. Well, there's absolutely no evidence of such a thing at all. Other critics have studied the content of it and have found much in it which seemed to them to refer to the northern kingdom and to be hardly fit with the idea of it having been written by priests in the southern kingdom. And so they say it was written a century or so before written in the northern kingdom. The northern kingdom was conquered by the Assyrians, according to this theory. In some way, this book was taken to the southern kingdom. Certain changes made in it. And it's not so easy to make changes in a manuscript like that, which is a long roll. You didn't have the nice glue like we have in our day. A lot of the conveniences we have today to take a long roll and insert things in order to make it fit with the southern kingdom. There'd have to be more than one person at least working on the proposition, and then to put it into the temple there and hide it there in order to be found. And of course the idea that it was found accidentally, that it wasn't hidden there by somebody, it's very strange to think. If somebody, say, put it there years ahead just in the hope somebody would find it and it would bring about such reforms. It's really difficult as the fraud theory is, it's really easier to believe in the fraud theory than it is to believe that it's purely an accident that a book written a century or two before Josiah or written even up in the northern kingdom would in some way have gotten down there, in some way gotten hidden in the temple or lost in the temple, and thus in some way found, and that people become so convinced it really was from Moses' hand that it would cause the great reform which the Bible describes as having taken place in the time of Josiah. And there even have been a few modern critics who have tried to say the general tone of the book is one of a settlement of a small group within the land rather than of people scattered all through it as they were in the time of Josiah. So this book must have been written in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah when there was just a little group that had come back from exile. Well, of course, if it would fit that time, it would fit even better the time of the settlement when Moses came in. There aren't many critics who have adopted that view of the later time, but there are a few who have done so. So much for number four. They try to evade the historical. Maybe we'll summarize what I just said. Number five, fundamental difficulties with this view. Fundamental difficulties with this view. And then number six, we do not question that Deuteronomy was central in Josiah's reforms, but that does not prove a late origin. We do not question that it was central in his reforms, but that does not prove a late origin. So much now for B, then capital C, other critical arguments for the date of Deuteronomy. Other critical arguments for the late date. Capital C. Number one, the critics say the general background of the book is late. They say the general background of the book is late. Small a, the monarchy is described in terms, they say, which plainly recall the reign of Solomon. You find in Deuteronomy the statement that the king shall have this book of the law before him, and that he shall not send to Egypt to get horses and build big establishments for himself, but he shall try to follow the law of the Lord and to do the Lord's will. They say all this is a reflection of what? Of Solomon's errors, and it recalls the reign of Solomon. However, we find even in Genesis, in the predictions that it was given that kings would come from his loins. It was expected that there would be kings of Israel, even though they did not have them at first. At first they considered the Lord their king, and they had the judges who reigned, but that was not a very satisfactory time, as is shown by the whole impression of the book of Judges. It was the expectation they would have kings. And if you have kings, there's always the possibility of the sort of thing described there. It does not require the events of Solomon's time to make such a statement. B, the prophetic order is pictured as active and strong, but requiring scrutiny of its claims. The prophetic order is pictured in Deuteronomy as active and strong, but requiring scrutiny of its claims. Now this is based upon chapter 13 and chapter 18. These are the places where Moses gives directions about the succession of the prophets who are to follow him. And he tells them that they want to know, how will we know the Lord's will after you are gone? God will raise up a prophet like unto me. Him shall ye hear. But he tells them that there are going to be those who will claim to be prophets, who will even predict the future correctly, who will even perform miracles, who will seem in every way to be great prophets of God, and yet who will tell them to go and worship idols, and that such men are to be destroyed. That he warns them very strongly against false prophets. Well, naturally, such thoughts would be in the minds of people in a day when you had the prophetic order as a strong and active factor in the land. But it would be just as natural for God to give warning of these situations in advance. And for Moses, after all he had gone through to express them, is nothing strange at all. Yes? B was that the prophetic order is strong and active, but requiring scrutiny of its claims. Then small c, various heathen practices forbidden. Various heathen practices forbidden, which were typical of this late time. You have various heathen practices specifically attacked in the book of Deuteronomy. You have some of these mentioned in 2 Kings as being practices that were found that crept into Israel at that time or that were among the neighboring lands. But this is no proof that these particular heathen practices were not equally present in the time of Moses. It could not be at all impossible for Moses to warn against practices, heathen practices that would arise at a later time. But that is not necessary in this case because some of them, there's abundant evidence in the time of Moses, and certainly no one can say when these heathen practices, of which very little is known, began. We have now a great deal of evidence from Babylonian and other sources as to hundreds of heathen gods. And some of them we know a great deal about their beliefs in, others we know very little about their beliefs in. These spread with the different tribes, different groups as they went here and there, and there is not such a specific relationship to heathen practice as known in the time of Josiah to make the argument really any stronger than to say that it is an attack on heathen practices as known in the time of Moses. That was C, I believe. Then capital D is the book contains general warnings of the danger of deportation abroad and of captivity in a foreign land. Was that? Small D, yes. General warnings of danger of deportation abroad and of captivity in a foreign land. It is true that in the time when the northern kingdom had been taken captive, led off into a foreign land into captivity, and when there appeared a pressing danger that the same thing might happen to the southern kingdom, it would be quite appropriate to give warning of such a thing. But the people of Israel under Moses had come out from Egypt where they had been captives in a foreign land. Pharaoh and his army had pursued after them in order to bring them back as captives. It's the most natural thing in the world in giving them advice about their life in the new land into which they are to go, to say that they should follow the Lord and be true to him, and that if they do not, God can cause them to be taken off into captivity again. We find these threats of captivity very clearly in the book of Deuteronomy, But there is no reason, even from a human viewpoint, why they might not have been given by Moses. And incidentally, in the threat of captivity in Deuteronomy, it is said that they will be, if they turn away from God, they will be taken into captivity, and so many of them will be sold as slaves in Egypt that the price of slaves in Egypt will go way down. And there's no evidence that such a thing happened in the days of the later Israelite kingdom, or even that there was danger of it. They were not taken captive to Egypt. They were taken over to the opposite direction, over to Babylonia and to Assyria. There would hardly anybody in that time have thought seriously of the danger of being taken to Egypt. But indeed, these prophecies that God made were fulfilled later on when the Romans conquered the land, and when thousands, after the destruction of Jerusalem, were sold as slaves into Egypt. And exactly that took place, which is predicted in Deuteronomy as the fate which would come if they turned away from God. So much then for number one, the critical claim that the general background of the book is late. A second critical claim, number two, is that there is a great difference in its style from that of other books of the Pentateuch, and a great similarity to that of later books. A great difference from that of other books of the Pentateuch, and a great similarity to that of later books. Actually, of course, the style of Deuteronomy is very different from the style of J.E. J and E are narrative. D is, as the critics say, paranetic, which is another word for saying hortatory. It is made up of exhorting people to obey the law. It is a special type of presentation. But there's no reason why one person could not have used a strong hortatory style at times, and at other times have used a simple narrative style. And the difference from the style of J and E is not as great as it might appear. Actually, Divetti himself, comparing the style of Deuteronomy with that of E and that of J, at that time, you remember, there was just one E, P was considered part of E at that time, Divetti said that it was so like J that he thought perhaps the Jehovah's who wrote the J document also was the writer of Deuteronomy. And so while the style is very different, it is not a difference such as would necessarily imply a different writer. And of course, in addition to that, it is not at all improbable that most of the narrative portions of the Pentateuch were written by Moses early in the wilderness journey. But nobody could believe that Deuteronomy was written early in the wilderness journey, because it is the farewell addresses given by Moses at the end. And in the course of 40 years of directing the people, 40 years of urging them to obey the law, 40 years of dealing with their problems and difficulties as they came up, a man's style would naturally change to some extent. Now, some of the critics claim that it rests upon the laws of J.E. and does not upon the laws of P. But actually, while the style of P, you might say, is still more different, because P is enumerative, genealogical, statistical, that sort of thing, laying out specifically little details of the conduct of the sacrifice and all that, yet there are portions of Leviticus in which the style rises to a paranetic sort of style. One or two critics have even said these were passages which were actually by D, but most do not hold so. But there is not such a difference from the style of the other books, either of J and E or of P, as the general statement of the critics would suggest. Then a third claim of the critics is that it has a very special relation to the reforms of Josiah. that it has a very special relation to the reforms of Josiah. But this is it is true that the book was doubtless very vital in producing Josiah's reforms. That is true. But so also probably were the other books of the Pentateuch, and the relation has been exaggerated in the critical statements. Now, a D, I'm going to give a sort of a summary of our answer to D, to C here in D. It's sort of a summary of it. D, the alleged differences between Deuteronomy and the other sections of the Pentateuch do not require a development theory, but are easily explained by the circumstances of Moses' time. The alleged differences between Deuteronomy and other sections of the Pentateuch do not require a development theory, but are easily explained by the circumstances of Moses' time. And then a further summary, capital E. There are definite points of agreement between the style of Deuteronomy and that of other portions of the Pentateuch, semaphore. There are definite points of agreement between the style of Deuteronomy and that of other portions of the Pentateuch, semaphore. The differences do not go beyond what might be expected in view of the different purpose. Yes. There are definite points of agreement between the style of Deuteronomy and that of other portions of the Pentateuch. The differences do not go beyond what might be expected in view of the different purpose. The purpose of Deuteronomy is exhortation. The purpose of the rest of the Pentateuch is explanation of the history, or presentation of specific laws for the priests to have in mind in carrying out matters that were not necessary for everybody to know all the details about. There is a different purpose in Deuteronomy from the other books. There is naturally then a considerable difference in the style that would be used in producing the different purpose. Now that is F. E was it? E, thank you. That was E. Then F will be specific difficulties. Specific difficulties with the critical view. Specific difficulties with the critical view. Specific difficulties with the critical view. Number one, Deuteronomy deals with a wide range of subjects. Deuteronomy deals with a wide range of subjects, many of them having no relation to the time of Josiah. Deuteronomy deals with a wide range of subjects, many of them having no relation to the time of Josiah. We have all sorts of laws and regulations in Deuteronomy which would be very important in the Israelites being settled in the land and in their situation there, but which would have no relation to this later time at all. For instance, in chapter 7 and in chapter 20, very strong laws given for extermination of the Canaanites. You remember back in the time of Jacob, God had said that the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. He gave them four more centuries for their iniquity and wickedness to reach the point where it was God's will that they be entirely blotted out from the earth. And then when he was ready to bring the Israelites up out of Israel and to give them the Canaanites' land for them to settle in, and when it was his determination to destroy entirely the Canaanites for this sin which had thus reached its extreme point after these four centuries, he gave the law for complete extermination of the Canaanites. And in chapter 25, there is the injunction to destroy the Amalekites. Now, someone has said that to have a law given at the time of Josiah commanding to exterminate the Canaanites when there had been no Canaanites there for centuries, and to destroy the Amalekites who had disappeared centuries before, would be about as sensible as promulgating a law in England now that they were to be on the watch for the Spanish Armada, or that they were to exterminate the Danes who tried to conquer England back about 1000 A.D. There are many of these laws which would be utterly antiquarian in the time. And the critics, of course, say they put in a certain number of these in order to make it look like an old law. But, of course, with that sort of argument, you can prove anything. Mr. Barr? Well, the only evidence you would have would be the biblical statements. They were just as available then as now. We really have very little other evidence, because the Egyptians wrote on papyrus, which in their very dry land, some of it has been preserved in graves, and they wrote in monuments on stone, and the Babylonians wrote on clay tablets, which have lasted. But the Israelite writing was mostly on ephemeral materials, and there's very little left. But the evidence was probably just as complete for them then as it is for us today. There are many laws dealing with matters that were quite out of date then, many with matters which must have seemed very trivial at that time, and it's very strange to think of these being put in a book written in the Northern Kingdom a century before and brought down to the South and put in here somewhere, or in a pious rot written at that time. Then number two, the critics exaggerate the prominence of centralization of worship. The critics exaggerate the prominence of centralization of worship, both in Deuteronomy and in the reforms of Josiah. We have noticed that Deuteronomy very clearly lays down the law for the time when the Lord has given them rest from their enemies and they dwell in safety, that the religious life is to center in one place to which they are to bring their sacrifice. That is clearly stated there Deuteronomy, but it is not stressed in the rest of the book. There is comparatively little in Deuteronomy that has anything to do with centralization of worship. And in the book of Josiah, in the book of Kings, and speaking about Josiah, it is perfectly clear that what Josiah was destroying was paganism. He was destroying idolatry, which they found in many places. His central push was not let worship be concentrated in Jerusalem, but let idolatrous practices be removed both from Jerusalem and from the many places outside in which idolatrous worship was being carried on by the Israelites at that time. The central feature of Josiah's reform was doing away with idolatry, not a centralization of worship. So that is greatly exaggerated in the critical claims about the book of Deuteronomy. As a matter of fact, you remember we've called attention to the command in Deuteronomy to build the altar on Mount Ebal. and to make sacrifices there. Of course, the critics say that is inserted from the Jehu gospel. But when they admit that most of Deuteronomy is a unit, to say that these four verses were stuck in at that point is purely an imaginary argument with no basis in fact for it at all. Then, number three, there is not the slightest trace, in Deuteronomy of the division of Israel into two kingdoms. There's not the slightest trace in Deuteronomy. Israel is throughout treated as one nation. Now, after the reign of Solomon, the land was divided into two parts, the largest in the north, but the one which included Jerusalem being the southern part, and this had continued for centuries till this time. And then there had come the great conquest and carrying off into exile of the people of the northern kingdom. And for the book to be written at the time of Josiah or written shortly before that time, and we have not the slightest trace of this tremendous change which had occurred in the whole situation of Israel, is a very strong argument against its late date. And then capital G is the critical claim, regarding certain phrases in the book has already been answered. Earlier, we looked at the early attacks on the genuineness of the Pentateuch by the phrase, for instance, beyond Jordan, and we discussed that quite fully, as you remember. The phrase beyond Jordan, we also discussed the phrase, the mention of the bedstead of Og, and we mentioned the phrase unto this day, which occur a number of times. We mentioned them in our earlier discussion of attacks on the origin of Pentateuch that were made before the present Christian began. Yes, Mr. Barton? You don't think we discussed Og's bedstead? Well, we'll say just a word about it then. It has been, it was maintained back in the 16th century that the reference to Og, that he had a bedstead of iron, that this could not be, in Deuteronomy 3:11, that this could not be written at the time, that this must be a much later time when it would be looked at as a strange thing to look back that he had a bedstead of iron. But of course, we now know that the time when the Israelites came into the land was just the very beginning of the Iron Age. The bronze was used for most expensive implements at that time. Most implements of war were of bronze rather than of iron, until the time of David. But that a few were just beginning to come in. So great sources of iron were known to the Philistines, and that's what gave the small group of Philistines their great strength. And that Og had a bedstead of iron, there's no reason why he could not have, this could not have occurred, but it would not be accessible to even the average king at the time, and so it would be a thing well worth mentioning at that time. Well, our conclusion then regarding Deuteronomy, is that it is unprovable if one can believe that Moses really lived, and if one can believe that there really is a God who spoke through Moses, there's no difficulty in believing that Deuteronomy is a genuine product of Moses' time. If one can believe that Moses really lived, and that there is a God who spoke through Moses, then there is certainly no difficulty in accepting the traditional date for Deuteronomy. Now 16 is later developments and conclusion. Later developments and conclusion regarding the Wellhausen theory. Later developments and conclusion regarding the Wellhausen theory. Under this, a rise of form criticism. Rise of form criticism. Here the name of Hermann Gunkel is important. G-U-N-K-E-L. Hermann Gunkel, who lived in Germany at about the beginning of the century, fully accepted the Wellhausen theory. But Gunkel studied archaeology far more than Wellhausen did. And Gunkel raised the question not what was the origin of the documents, he accepted what Wellhausen said, but Gunkel raised the question, where did the portions of the documents come from? And he originated the form theory, that is to say, trying to find a situation in life in which a story would have been invented, or in which a certain law would have been originated, or a psalm written, like a marriage psalm or a coronation psalm or something like that. And Gunkel's writings were not considered in opposition to the Wellhausen theory, but gradually his writings turned the attention of many to individual parts of the document. And more they have come to the conclusion, well, this part of J looks like something would have been very early, this part of P looks like something would be very early. And today, instead of thinking of the documents as written and originated at the time when the criticism says they were, the present tendency is to think that they are conglomerations of material, a great deal of which was very early. And even the most advanced critics today will say that P, though it's very late, contains some very early material. Now this form criticism, which Gunkel originated, led to B, the traditio historical approach. And the traditio, T-R-A-D-I-T-I-O, hyphen, historical approach, largely developed in the last 30 years in Scandinavia. Sometimes it's called the Scandinavian school. And a group of scholars in Scandinavia have gone into the Pentateuch looking at it not as documents which were united, but as little sections which originated at different times from different causes and which were passed on by word of mouth. Some of them think nothing was written down at all till after the exile. It was passed on and changed and gradually conglomerated. And people in England and other places who held to the Wellhausen theory said, well, after all, the Scandinavians are dealing with the same blocks of material that we do, even they're getting the origin, the individual part of the blocks. And there was the Scandinavians for a time attacked the Wellhausen theory very vehemently, said this documentary idea is absolute nonsense. Each section developed in oral tradition here and there. And today, the hostility toward the traditio-historical has largely disappeared. And so today their books are being translated into English and being highly praised by some of the supporters of the Wellhausen school. Now capital C, C is decline of the development emphasis. Decline of the development emphasis. You will find many critical scholars today who will say there are no Wellhausenists left. Nobody holds the Wellhausen anymore. As long ago as 40 years ago, Professor Albright said to me, there are only two Orthodox Wellhausenists in Germany, and they're not Orthodox. Yes? Yes, be with the traditional historical church. Yes. And by that he meant that they do not hold, as Wellhausen and the others did, to this natural, simple development of ideas which reached the great height of monotheism, eventually. This sort, they say, all of them, we no longer believe in straight line evolution. And so the development aspect is largely being pushed to the side, but they're holding to the partition idea as firmly as ever. And as Albright says, referring to most of the leading scholars in this field today, hold that the J document is itself two different documents, as I've mentioned before. Albright speaks of this as a queer aberration, the idea there are two documents and so on. But he says, of the original independent existence of the great documents, J, E, D, and P, there can be no doubt. So most of them are holding thus to the main essentials of the partition theory. And forgetting that the partition theory went through all these different changes, as we noticed, until finally one particular formula fit with the development theory and the two were joined together, and that's what gave them their solid start. When Dr. Speiser wrote his book not long ago on the Anchor series, his commentary on Genesis, in which he has a tremendous amount of archaeological material applied to Genesis, not much of it previously unpublished, and has received great acclaim from most readers of the book. He devotes maybe a third of the book to telling how this is part of the J document. This, which was previously thought to be P, can't be P because archaeology shows that it was a common such a statement, and therefore it can be considered part of J like the rest. Of the context. He follows the Wellhausen theory straight through and devotes a lot of space to it. And a review by a professor in Union Theological Seminary says that it was to be regretted that in this wonderful book, Speiser devoted so much attention to the Wellhausen theory, which may, after all, one of these days be superseded by an entirely different field. And I've read statements recently by critics who say we are not wed to the Wellhausen theory. Some other theory may explain the origin, but they say we should never forget that we are indebted to the Wellhausen theory for having put an end to the old idea of verbal inspiration. In other ways, among the critical theories, critical scholars today, there are very few who believe we know anything much about motives. There may have been a man at that time who was a great leader, but that one statement in 50 of the statements in the Pentateuch is true, hardly any of them would believe. They simply assume that the material about the early days of Israel is all imagination and theory from a later time, some of it perhaps resting on fact, but nobody knows which part. That is the result which has come from the Wellhausen theory. To my mind, there is nothing which has been more effective in destroying faith in God, faith in the Bible, than the widespread acceptance of the Wellhausen theory and the other theories which have received their start and their push as a result of acceptance of this theory. And today, there are not many who can give solid arguments for the theory. It's simply something that is believed by the rank and file of unbelieving scholars, while the leaders of it are making changes here and there in it and developing new theories and aspects and saying maybe it'll disappear and be supplanted by another. But it has completely broken them from the tie with the idea that there is here a supernatural book, a book which God actually directed, but in which God entered into human life, dealt with humanity on human level, dealt with situations of the day, dealt with situations of the time that was to come in the future, laid out the line which would be developed until they reached their great climax in the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ to fulfill the sacrifice and to fulfill the promises of the Old Testament and to bring us the means of salvation. And so today, in dealing with the critical theory, we are in a very peculiar situation because we're dealing with something which is put in Sunday school literature, in common books popular use, in references in encyclopedias, in magazines, in other books, as established fact, and yet which very few people today know much about real evidence in favor of. But it has a solid position in the general attitude toward the Bible of people today, and it constitutes a great block in their way of their believing in a supernatural God who spoke through the Bible and who through it prepared the way for the coming of His Son. It's a hard thing to take a hold of this, to know just what way to deal with it in order to try to change people's attitude toward it. But I think to have an understanding of what it is, an understanding of how it came into existence, an understanding of what elements of truth there are that enter into it, for there is nothing that's entirely false, it would die completely of itself. It rests upon a certain amount of emphasis on true aspects, which have not been given their proper weight by others, but that essentially it rests upon an attitude that is contrary to the teaching of the Word of God and contrary to sound logic. And of course, I think it's very vital for us to realize today that the partition aspect, which is still so solidly accepted by nearly all of the New Testament scholars, the Old Testament scholars, and which is today assumed by people in all other fields of thought when they refer to this, that the partition aspect was a part of an attitude which was so common a century ago, or maybe even up to 40 years ago, but which today is just practically a discard. Picked up a book last week written just within the last year on Greek studies, in which there's an article on Homer. And he says, maybe we don't know who Homer was. Maybe we don't know when he lived. But he says, such a great masterpiece as the Iliad and the Odyssey could not come into existence by chance. They couldn't come into existence by the activity of a number of people. There's one great mind that is back of it. He used phrases that were current with others. He used some poetic expressions that others were using. He went about as a minstrel as others were doing. All these things enter in. But there's a great mind, there's a great unity back of it. And they're coming more and more to realize that about Homer. Even today, more than 10 years ago there were quite a few who were strongly insisting that Homer was made up of different sections put together. They're becoming less and less. And it is just not being done regarding other works anymore now. Of course, there may come another swing. They may go into it again. Because there was a very great swing. They were doing it to most everything a century ago. But the attitude toward the Bible was a part of this swing. It was slower in getting to the Bible than other literature. But when it got there, it clung to it longer. I picked up the first edition of the Cambridge Ancient History, which was published early in this century, and in the introduction they said, readers will be surprised to find that the Pentateuch, which they have always thought of as a unit, has now been proved to be simply a collection of various documents written at different times, combined together. On the other hand, they will be surprised to find that Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, which most of them had come to realize were made up of different lays combined together, is now believed to be by one author. That was what they were saying 50 years ago. They moved, first they disintegrate Homer, then they disintegrate the Bible, then they look at Homer again as a unit. But by that time, they have destroyed widespread the interest in the Bible. It is really sad today when you look at the great mass of our people. My guess is 95% of the American people are religiously illiterate, certainly of the educated people. They know a tremendous amount of other things. They know practically nothing about the Bible. You ask them who were the sons of Noah, and they may say Cain and Abel. They're just that ignorant regarding the Bible. Educated, highly educated people. They just know nothing about it. Our land has a famine of the knowledge of the Word of God. And the higher criticism has been a very big factor in building up that family. Now we want to be able to answer it. We want to be able to deal with it. But whether in the end we'll be able to deal with it by argument, or whether if it is to be dealt with, the Lord will have to send a great revival that turns people back to the Word of God, turns them back to looking to Christ for salvation, and then they take a different attitude to the Bible. No human being can say. Now, we will have a test tomorrow morning, as you know, which will deal this time mostly with material since the last test.